Okay, everyone, welcome to Parsha in My Life, Parshas Ki Sisa, this week's Torah portion, and we're going to have some good, serious learning today. And I chose this because it's very applicable today's days. So let's get right to it. So in this week's Torah portion, there is a very sad story. It talks about the golden calf. And God being upset at the Jewish people very much after the sin of the golden calf. And then Moses comes to the rescue and he's trying to gain forgiveness. Hold on, just want to make sure this is not going to ring. Gain atonement. And he basically does that by volunteering to have his name erased from the Torah. Fine. After the primary back and forth with God first being upset with Israel, saying he wants to wipe them out with the Jewish people, and then the reconciliation coming through Moshe. Before Moshe gained complete forgiveness, before he gained to bring the Jewish people back to the good graces, so there was forgiveness, there was already enough of a promise that God would not do what he had intended to do, a complete wipeout. But you can still see that the wedge was still there. There was still a lack of intimacy and closeness. Later in the Torah portion, Moshe is going to work on that. He's like going to massage the relationship. And he does that for 40 days, 40 nights from the month of Elul, the beginning of Elul until Yom Kippur. Until he restores the relationship to where it was before, and even deeper than where it was before. That happens at the end. But we're getting to talk about some verses that happen like right in the middle when the forgiveness was given, but there was still a little grudge left over. So God says to Moshe at that point, get ready and to take the Jewish people into the land. However, you should know that I'm not coming with you. Instead, I'm going to send an angel to accompany you. Right? So that's what we're going to study now is chapter 33, Perek Lamed Gimel, in verse number 1, Pasuk Aleph. Vaydabar Hashem al Moshe, Hashem says to Moshe, Leich, go, alei mezeh, go up from here. He's go towards the promised land, which is higher up, as Rashi says, the land of Israel is higher than all the other countries. Also, Rashi says this was kind words on God's end, because God had spoken very sternly at Moshe when the golden calf was made. He said, "Descend." He said, "Go down," and meaning to also say, "I'm going to diminish you from all your levels, your high levels of closeness to me." So here, God is telling Moshe, ascend, go back up. Okay? So that's nice. But then he says, Atayu, Va'amashar Alisam Eretz Mitzrayim, together with the nation that you took out of Egypt, which is a little bit of a cold statement, because he doesn't say my nation, he says your nation that you took out of Egypt. Ela Oretz, to the land, Ashenishbati, in other words, I'm not going back on my promise. You will go, Ela Oretz, to the land, Ashenishbati, Lavrom, Leitzak, Leyakov, to the land that I promised Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Lamor saying, Lazarecha atnena, to your children, meaning I made a promise and I'm going to keep my promise. The golden calf is not going to get in the way of my promise to give the Jewish people the promised land. But however, here is the not good news. Vishalachti lefanecha malach, I will send before you an angel. And that angel will do what? Vigerashti, this is already verse number 2. Vigerashti, and I will drive out through my angel, I will drive out esaknani, Ha'amoiri, v'achiti, v'haprizi, hachivi, v'ayavusi. I will drive out the ancient nations that are living, the natives of the land of Israel. God says, I will drive them out, and then I will bring you in, and you will settle the land. I'm taking away a land from them, and I'm giving it to you. But you're going to have divine assistance, not through me, but through angelic beings. Okay. In the end, we're going to see that Moshe doesn't like that. Moshe protests that. And he says, if you're not going with us, we're not going. That's pretty gutsy on Moshe's end. But he's the defender of Israel. And in the end, he gains God consent on that as well. And God says, I will come along with you. That's what you see later in the Torah portion. Now, there is a Rashi over here. On the words, I will drive the Kanani out of the land. So this is, I made a copy over there. So after I read to you verse number two, I read verse number one and verse number two. Verse number two you have in your copy over there. But verse number two, the Rashi says, Vegarashti es haKanani. So Rashi makes a statement. Again, Rashi, the chief commentator on the Chumash. Rashi says that it's very strange that there are only six nations mentioned here, not seven. We know already from the first Rashi in the Torah that there are seven ancient nations, that the land of Canaan, the land of Canaan, which later becomes the land of Israel, was a land inhabited by seven tribes, seven nations. So, but over here, when God says, I will drive out the nations, he only mentions six. Who are they? Kanani, Amori, Chiti, Prizi, Chivi, and Yevusi. Six are mentioned. So Rashi is seemingly perturbed. What happened with the seventh? Where are the Gergashites? And Rashi says, Shisha Umoisein, these are six nations. But what happened with the seventh? Well, the seventh is called Gergashi. Var Gergashi Omad, and the Gergashi stood up, Upana Mipneim, and left Me'elav on their own. That means they vacated. The other six nations put up a fight. And because they put up a fight, God is saying, I'm gonna have to drive them out. My angel is going to do the battle for you. However, the Gergashi did not have to be mentioned over here because God knew what was going to happen, that the Gergashites, the Gergashi nation, was going to leave on its own. And that's what they did. They packed their bags and they left. It doesn't say in Rashi where they went, but this statement, I think, is taken from Midrash Rabbah and in other places. Well, it says that the Gergashi people, they left to Africa. So they moved on to Africa. Somewhere in Africa is where the Gergashites are hanging out. Fine. The question we have, now this is going to be an interesting discussion, because the reason I'm speaking about this now is because we are standing now right before the Jewish people are meant to take possession of the entire land of Israel. That's why we're seeing the tension in the Middle East. It's all about the Jewish people taking possession of the land and building our temple that we discussed 2 weeks ago in the amazing class about the temple, about the Ark. So the news is, the important news is that it's ours, and it's going to be ours, and for the whole world to see. And this one and that one, and whoever's trying to mess with it is to stop it, it's unstoppable. If you look in the Bible, you look in the Torah, you find promise after promise after promise that God promises the land to the Jewish people, and with enormous intensity. And this is repeated again and again. And this itself, that the nations of the world are going to make problems, all of this is prophesied. And as we discussed, it's mentioned in the first Rashi in the Torah, that this is going to be a global outcry, like you're watching now, the nations all crying and saying, you're living on occupied land. Blinken now, the State Department, has reversed a change that the State Department had made during the Trump years under Pompeo, which was consistent with biblical prophecy, where over there the United States supported the Yehuda and Shamron, which is falsely called the West Bank, as they call it occupied land, and that they say the settlements are illegal, internationally illegal settlements. Pompeo and recognized these settlements. Now comes Biden with his Blinken, And I was warning that we shouldn't elect Biden. And people thought, I'm not going to get into the politics of it. It's too painful even to talk about. But, you know, obviously there is a great divine plan that is playing out now as well. We're just going to watch and see how this is all going to unfold. And obviously each and every one of our own mitzvot and good deeds that we do can assist in this project, especially based on what we're going to speak about today. They just now, last week, Blinken announced his, like, you know, the settlements are, I guess he's trying to appease the Palestinians and the and maybe a certain voting bloc that is very angry at Biden for his so-called support of Israel, which I can't say is not. We have to give recognition where there was recognition, but not the full recognition like I think the previous administration would have had in an unbelievable way after October 7th. But again, my intention today is not to talk politics. But the notion that so in any moment we're going to be taking this land, and as I'm mentioning, you know, to all the protests of whoever wants to protest, you know, there's a statement: you can't fight City Hall, you can't fight God's will. So it's the only thing is Israel has to have the wisdom to speak the truth and to stand up there and say that this is our land because God promised it to us. And therefore, we're not going anywhere. And we're not giving an inch of our land. And if the Arabs want to live here in peace and tranquility, then they can join our country. But if they want to make trouble, then they're not going to be allowed to do so. And that's it. Israel is afraid to say that because they don't want to sound like fanaticals, that they're coming from a biblical claim. Because then they're going to sound like the Muslims who are using religious argument. And they want to sound like the sophisticated ones. But you're not going to win this war that way. It's either you're going to speak truth or you're going to fumble and bumble. And if you fumble and bumble, then you're going to cave under world pressure. So I think the pressure is just going to force Israel to have to say the truth. Let's hope it doesn't go that far, but it looks like that's where it's going to. But in any case, so I want to teach this teaching particularly today, because this is the teaching that talks about those resistant, last pockets of resistance, which is now in Gaza and some other places where there's still some last pockets of resistance to the Jewish land being the Jewish homeland promised by God, how this resistance is eliminated. Is it through a war? Or can it be achieved that those that are there just decide to pack their bags and leave? Well, we have, when the first time when we came in with Joshua, we had six of the seven nations who put up a fight, and they were decimated. Because again, you can't fight God. And so the Jews won with divine assistance, with miraculous victory. And then there were those who didn't even put up a fight. They left. Now, what we are going to see is an interesting connection I'd like to make between the Girgashites that we're actually talking about over here, who left on their own, with those that are living in Gaza. That's only going to be, however, that connection is going to be made all the way in the end of the class. Phenomenal connection. But we're going to have to hold our breath till we get there. First, we're going to dig a little deeper into this whole story with the Girgashite people who went to Africa. Now, the interesting thing is over here is that this comment that Rashi makes that the Girgashi nation vacated and left on their own, and therefore it wasn't necessary to have a war, is repeated two times by Rashi in the same Torah portion. And that is, let's take a look a little further. This was chapter 33, verse number 2. Now we're going to go ahead and look. I have a copy, so if you want, on the tables. Yeah, okay, you can listen. So now we take a little bit of a leap to next chapter in Exodus, in chapter 34. Again, in this week's Torah portion. Perek Lamed Dalid, And we go to verse number 11. Chapter 34, verse number 11. If you're listening on YouTube, you can grab a chumash. You can grab a Bible and look it up. And it says like this, Shmar Lecha. Here God is warning Israel that when you're going to come into the land, don't make any truces. Don't make any peace accords. Don't sit and make any ridiculous contracts. Don't do that. Don't play nice. Clean out the place if you don't want to have any trouble. The dwellers over there are only going to make you trouble. Don't make a covenant with them. Seems like what was true 3,000 years ago is true now again. It's good when we listen to the Torah. The Torah knows things that other people, all the smart, sophisticated people don't know. The Torah does know. The Torah says, don't make the foolish mistake. Don't make covenants. Don't make peace agreements. Ask them to leave. It doesn't mean, God forbid, wipe out all the people that are there. If the people that were living over there wanted to surrender and accept Jewish authority, which required paying taxes and various different things and living under the authority, they were allowed to do so. But it means to try to placate, giving them some kind of autonomous existence and so on and so forth, don't do that. Because it's going to come back to haunt you. The Torah warns about it so many times. But in any case, here we go. What does it say? Shmar lecha, be very careful, God says. Es asher anochi mitzav chayom, that which I am commanding you today. And God says like this, again, as we said earlier. Hinini goydesh mipanecha, I behold, I am driving out from before you. Es amori v'haknani v'hachiti v'haprizi v'hachivi v'hayavusi. I am driving out all these nations, the above named nations. How many nations are mentioned here? Again, the same six that were mentioned in the last chapter. And again, Girgashi is not mentioned. God says, I'm driving out all these nations. And what does he warn us in verse number 12? You don't have a copy. Yeah, it says that. Yeah, on the next page. If you look on the next page. Hisham alecha, be careful. Pentichra is bris, lest you make a covenant liyosheva aris to the dwellers of those lands. Asherat tabola, that you're coming into their land. Pen yia lomoikesh bikerbecha. Maybe they will become, if you will make deals with them, they will end up being a stumbling block before you. There will be shootings, there will be bombings, there will be stone throwing, there will be intifadas, there will be stabbings. There will be, if you like living like that, if you enjoy it, then go ahead, make deals, make peace deals. In addition to it will become a spiritual impediment because their pagan cultures will seep into you. You're still very vulnerable. And you might follow in their ways. When you come in there, their altars you should smash. And there are other stones that they set up. Their platforms, Teshaberun, you should break it. Sasherov, and the trees that they would plant for idols, also for their service of idols, Techroisun, you should cut them down. And then it goes on to say, don't bow down to their gods, whatever. Pentichris bris, maybe you will make a covenant, Leyosheva Aretz, to the dwellers of the land, and then that will cause you to go astray after their gods. And you'll mess up. You'll intermarry with them. No good. I'm bringing you to the land. I want this to be a Jewish land. The words of the Torah. Fine. But we're not going to go into what we're really interesting is that. Well, let's take a look at the Rashi on that verse where God says, "I am bringing you into the land," and And I will drive out the Amorites, the Knani, the Chiti, the Prizi, the Chivi, and the Yavusi. Let's take a look at Rashi. Esa Amori, Shisha Umois Yeshkan. Six nations are here. Rashi points out the same exact thing he pointed out earlier. And Rashi says, Ki ha-Girgashi amad upanem ipnehem. Because the Girgashi stood up and vacated from before them. News? It's as if we never knew this. Rashi's giving you new information. That's the question we have today. If Rashi made the comment just barely one chapter ago, Rashi is a very concise commentator. He doesn't repeat his comments twice. The only time Rashi repeats a comment twice is based on two conditions, two primary conditions. Condition number one, there is new information in the second time he says it over the first time. And when the first time he said it, this information was not available yet because it wasn't derived in the first local. It's something that we can only derive the second time, so Rashi will repeat it again because he wants to add more. But if there's no additional information, Rashi's not going to repeat the same thing. Or, sometimes, if it's in a different chumash, a chumash means it's in Torah, there are five books. So if it's in a complete different book, so Rashi's not going to rely, if I'm learning the book of Numbers, and Rashi said something already to us in the book of Exodus, or in the book of Genesis, Rashi might feel it important to remind us of a teaching that he said already, and it's not a problem by him repeating it twice. Because you might have forgotten it was said a long time ago. Or you might have started reading only from the fourth book and didn't read the first two, three books yet. But in one book, Rashi is relying that you're reading in order. So if you heard the comment already earlier. Now in this case, Rashi repeats the same thing without adding any more information. If you compare the two Rashis, they're almost verbatim. There are six nations that are mentioned here. What's with Girgashi? Girgashi packed their bags and left. The seventh one left on their own. It's exact same commentary. Now, it's not only that it's not in a different book. It's not even far apart in the same book. It's in the same Torah session that we read on one Shabbos, on one week. It's in Parsha. It's the same Parsha. Just one chapter further. Why does Rashi now repeat a teaching that he just told us a minute ago? Now, there is many commentators on Rashi. So there is a commentator called Maskil LeDavid. And the Maskil LeDavid, I don't know who authored it. It's just one Google search away. You can look it up. A commentator on Rashi, in which he explains why Rashi repeats the same comment the second time. And he says there's a big difference between verse 30, the first comment of Rashi in chapter 33, and the second comment of Rashi in chapter 34. What's the difference? The difference is that in chapter 33, we were still in the state where God was sending an angel. Remember, as I've said earlier, the angel is going to drive the nations out. In the second story, in the second time it's mentioned, Moshe had already appeased God, Moses had already appeased God, and God consented to come along himself. So therefore, since there is a change of plans between chapter 33 and chapter 34, there was a change of plans. So we might think that what? That since God himself is coming along this time, the entrance into the land is going to be far more spectacular, and the miracles are going to be so much greater than when the angel is doing it. It's going to be with far more power. And as a result of that, maybe you won't have to fight any of the nations. All of them will just run for the hills. So therefore, the verse is telling you, and Rashi, that's what the Maskil LeDavid said. That's why Rashi is repeating it again to tell you, no, this won't change. The six nations will still be, you'll still have to battle with them. of course, with divine assistance. You see, we know that when the Jews were battling, stones, massive stones fell from the sky. So there was pretty awesome divine assistance. The sun stopped for them for a couple of hours till they can finish the campaign. A military exercise, they were busy in order they shouldn't be hindered by the night. We had incredible miracles that were going on, right? But still, you're going to have to fight. And that's what Rashi wants to say, that it still remains the same. Only the Gergashi is going to vacate on their own. The other nations, you're going to have to fight. That is the Maskil of David's explanation why Rashi repeated it the second time, because it's necessary to understand that even though over here God himself is coming, this will still apply. The Rebbe, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, rejects his explanation. And the Rebbe says, according to his explanation, it goes against the entire energy of that Rashi. According to this explanation, the second Rashi is trying to emphasize nothing about the Gergashi. The Gergashi is not the problem. The problem is the other six nations. According to his explanation, you know, the fact that the Gergashi is leaving, that remains the same like before. If the Gergashi left on their own when the angel came, of course they're going to leave on their own when God himself is coming. The chiddush, the novelty is that the other six did not leave. Well, that's not the emphasis in Rashi. Rashi isn't emphasizing in the second Rashi Rashi should have said, V'rak ha-Gergashi, and only the Gergashi left, but the other six are not leaving. But that's not the way Rashi is speaking. Rashi just says six are mentioned, but the Gergashi, they stayed. I'm sorry, the Gergashi, they left on their own. Six will fight, but... So the emphasis in the second Rashi is exactly the same like the emphasis in the first Rashi. It's not like in the second Rashi he's flipping it over and the main comment is to emphasize how this that notwithstanding the fact that God himself is coming, Gergashi, the other six are still going to stay and fight. That's not implied in the Rashi at all. Let's read it. You tell me. The second Rashi, let me read the words. The verse says, Hineni gairish mipanecha, I am deriving out from you, Esamoyri, Knani, Chiti, Prizi, Chivi, Vivusi. Let's see what Rashi says. Esamoyri, Shisha umois yeshkan, six are here. Ki ha gergashi amadu panem epneim. Because the Gergashi left on their own. According to what the Maskil of David's explanation, it shouldn't be emphasizing the Gergashi left. It should have said that and even though I'm coming, the six still needed to be chased out. The emphasis Rashi seems to the added insight that he's adding to you. From Rashi, it implies is that the Gergashi left, not that the others stayed. But according to him, the main chiddush is that the main novelty is that the main point that he's trying to make is that the others stayed. And that's not implied here. And he asks another question, which why he's not satisfied with the Maskil of David. But I don't want to make the class too complicated, so we're going to keep it light. So the Rebbe has a whole different take on this, which is really just simple and brilliant, of why Rashi repeats both. It's just like he just blows it open, like he always does. But before that, he says, the simple reading of these Rashis is that Rashi is perturbed by the question why the Gergashi is not mentioned, right? And that's why Rashi comes to comment. Our question is only, why does Rashi have to say that twice? Once we know that Gergashi left on their own, so it's... But really, if that's really what was bothering Rashi, which it seems like it was, one can have a big question. All the way in the beginning of the book of Exodus... All the way in the beginning in the book of Exodus, in the first parsha Shemos, It mentions over there that God, when God meets Moshe at the burning bush, and God tells him, I'm sending you, Moshe, to take the people out. Tell them I am coming to take them out and to bring them to a land that flows milk and honey. So over there, God tells them that he's bringing them to the land. And over there as well, it mentions the nations that lived in the land. To the land of so, 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 and so. You know how many nations it mentions over there? It mentions 6. It doesn't mention 7. And guess who's missing? Girgashi is missing. And you know, if you look in Rashi, Rashi doesn't say a peep. Rashi doesn't explain why Girgashi is missing. And if you really want to hear something really amazing, it's not once in Parsha Shemos, it's 2 times in Parsha Shemos. 2 times in Parsha Shemos, it is mentioned that God says, I will bring you to the land of the nations. Both times it mentions 6 nations and the 7th is not mentioned. Girgashi is not mentioned. And Rashi did not say, doesn't even whisper to us. There's not a word. So if this is a problem when you're learning, if Rashi assumes we all know already that the land of Israel has 7 nations, Rashi's assuming that the child that is learning or anybody that's learning knows there are 7 nations. And based on that promise, he's bothered why it only mentions 6. In Parshas Kisisa, he's bothered by it twice. And in Parshas Shemos, it mentions it twice and Rashi doesn't say once a comment. Not only in Parshas Shemos, it's mentioned in Parshas Mishpatim as well. Further on, Parshas Mishpatim is another Torah portion in Exodus, before Kisisa. I'm going to read to you all these verses. And over there, it also mentions 6 nations. And again, Rashi doesn't say a boo. So why does Rashi suddenly wake up with such vigor in Parshas Kisisa, and both times he has to make the same comment? It's what I love about the Rebbe. He has the entire Torah always in front of his eyes. It's visual to him. He sees it all in one shot. So you can't pull a fast one on him. It's amazing. So he points out, wait a minute, like, hold it. Why did Rashi say it? Let me read to you where it is. In the book of Shemos. In the book of Shemos, it says like this. Oh, the first one is in chapter 3, Pere Gimel, Pasuk Yud Zayin, verse number, again, chapter 3 in Exodus, verse 17. Va'oimar, and I said, A'ala eschem, I will take you up, me'oni Mitzrayim, from the infliction of Egypt, el eretz ha'knani, to the land of the Knani, va'achiti, va'amoyri, va'aprizi, va'achivi, va'ayavusi. Yeah. 6, not 7. And then it says, El Eret Zavas Chalav Advash, to the land that flows milk and honey. Look at Rashi, checking it out. No Rashi, nothing. And so you would say, yeah, probably no one notices it. No, other commentaries do notice it. Over there, other commentaries may comment on it in right over there on its place the first time. Who? The Ibn Ezra makes a comment on it right over there. Does he? No, maybe the second time, hold it. But the Ramban. Yud Zion, give me a minute. Again, you got yourself locked out. No, come on. Hold on over here. Mexico. Come on. I'm so sure. Wait. Give me a second, eh? Oh, I know why. Because I mentioned to you the second time of Shemos. I missed the first one. I knew it's the first one. I knew something is wrong. Okay, let's go back. I told you now chapter 3, verse 17. Let's go back. It's chapter 3, verse 8. So it's twice. Chapter 3, verse 8, Pasuk Ches and Pasuk Yud Zayin. So in Pasuk Ches, it says like this, Ve'ered la'atziloi, God says to Moshe, this is all a conversation during the meeting by the burning bush. And yet God didn't have to be afraid that the bush would get burnt by the time he finishes the conversation, because the bush wasn't burning, even though it was burning. Right? It says it wasn't getting consumed. They had enough time to talk. Actually, it says that Moshe spoke to God for 7 days. He was arguing. But anyways, Ve'ered la'atziloi miyad Mitzrayim, God says, I've descended to save him from the hand of the Egyptians. U'la'aloisay, and to bring him up in Aretz Ahu, from that land. El Eretz Toiva Rechava, to a good land and a broad land. El Eretz Zavas Chalav Edvash, to a land that flows milk and honey. And watch this. El Mekoyim HaKnani, to the place of the Knani, the Chiti, the Amori, Vaprizi, Achivi, Vayavusi. There's no Girgashi. And again, look in Rashi, not a word. But look in Ibn Ezra. Yevela Hisker HaGirgashi. HaGirgashi is not mentioned. So the Ibn Ezra offers his reason. Ki hu katan min hashiva, because this was the smallest of the seven. It wasn't a major, it was small, so it didn't feel that the verse, even though it was a tribe and a people and they had a land, but it was insignificant compared to the others. So the verse doesn't mention it. That's his explanation. Nachmanides also touches upon it. And I'm going to leave Nachmanides' answer for later. But the other commentators do point it out in Parsha Shemos, where it belongs, because that's the first time it's omitted. Rashi doesn't say a word. He waits till Parsha's Kisisa, and then he comments on it twice. So I'm sure most people don't lose too much sleep on this. Question is, how much does it bother us that Rashi does this? Who can't sleep at night? The Rebbe can't sleep at night. He can only come up with such answers only if you can't sleep at night, when the question bothers you to no end. That's when you really work hard, you understand? So, but the Rebbe is bothered by this question to no end. How come Rashi didn't comment earlier? Now, I just want to show you also Parshas Mishpatim, where it's mentioned. I mentioned to you that it's mentioned also in Parshas Mishpatim over here. We were reading these verses a few weeks ago when we were talking about the blessings of the land. Remember, we were learning about not having any stillborn babies, and then we had this beautiful class on it. Also, we learned the Rashi then. So, in Parshas Mishpatim, which is in Exodus chapter 23. It says, behold, I am sending an angel before you to guard you, to bring you to the place that I have prepared. And then the verse says, Kielach, this is easy to remember, chapter 23, verse 23. What does it say? Kielach malachi lefanecha, my angel will go, vaviyacha, and he will bring you. Ela moiri, chiti, prizi, knani, chivi, yavusi. Six nations, doesn't mention the Girgashi. Take a look at Rashi, nada, nothing. Rashi had a chance three times to comment on it, he doesn't. In Parshas Kisisa, two times. What was Rashi? He had a lot of coffee that day. He was very alert. In Parshas Kisisa, not so alert. Doesn't make any sense. What's the reason? How can you explain this? So the Rebbe offers. He says, Parshas Mishpatim, we can excuse Rashi. but not in Shemos. In Mishpatim, we could give Rashi a reason why he didn't. Because in Parshas Mishpatim, the opening of this whole subject is, the verse says, God says to Moshe, I am sending an angel, and the angel will go ahead. And Rashi is bothered. Sending an angel? Why is God sending an angel? Wasn't God supposed to come along with them? So Rashi says, this conversation with God that God had with Moshe was before the Jewish people sinned, when the plan was that God was going. But God is hinting to Moshe, you should know, that trouble is brewing. I know there is going to be a mess up. God knows beforehand what's going to happen. I know there is going to be a mess up. I will not be the one going. In the end, I will send an angel. So this is God telling Moshe about something that is going to happen later. He's giving him earlier alert, earlier notification about events that were going to happen later and the consequences of those events. He's giving him a little bit of a pre, I don't know what you call it, a preview or a prelude, maybe, that it shouldn't shock Moshe so much when it happened. He's softening the punch. So therefore, the Rebbe says, so then we can understand. Since this whole story about God sending the angel, this is in Parshas Mishpatim, it's not the main story. It's only giving us a little bit in pre-information before it happened. So Rashi, we can understand, is relying on the main story. He will explain it well when he gets to the main story. But that's when we're dealing in Parshas Mishpatim, talking about the angel bringing them into the land. But in Parsha Shemos, it's not talking about an angel bringing them. It's talking about the general promise that God says, I'm taking them out of Egypt, bringing them to the land of the nations, speaking about all the seven nations. How come over there he doesn't comment and tell us why Girgashi is not mentioned? So the answer to all of this, brilliant. The Rebbe says like this. Parsha Shemos, the context of the beginning of Exodus, of Parsha Shemos, is very different than the context in Parsha Kisisa. It's actually talking about two different things. In Parsha Shemos, we're not talking about the nations. We're not talking about the inhabitants. We are talking about the territory. We're talking about the land. God says, I am taking you up from the land of Egypt, and I am bringing you to the land of milk and honey. Which land is that? The land of the Canaanite, the Chiti, the Prizi, the Amori, the Yavusi, whatever, all the Chivi. All these are the six nations that are there. He's talking about the land. And he emphasizes very much how that's a magnificent land. So there is no question over there why it's not mentioned Girgashi. That that land was not such prime real estate like the other. It wasn't that high quality land. God is saying, I'm bringing you to an awesome land. He's mentioning the lands that are like, this is like the best, most fertile lands. The Girgashites could have been inhabiting part of the land of Israel that was not such grade A land, such superb land. And therefore, on the simple level, again, Rashi is sticking to very simplistic interpretation. It's not a question why it's not mentioned. God is highlighting the special lands. And Girgashi did not make the cut. And that's why in both statements in the beginning of Exodus and Parsha Shemos, in both these places it's speaking about the land. Rashi didn't feel compelled to comment what happened with Girgashi. It's self-understood that Girgashi is not of that excellence. Now, by the way, Nachmanides offers that comment in Shemos. Nachmanides says that. Remember I told you that Nachmanides gives explanation? He says that explanation. Let me read it to you inside. And you'll just wonder, if Nachmanides said it, how come Rashi didn't say it? And the answer could have been that Rashi understood that from the context of the verse itself, it's self-understood. Because the verse says openly, Ered Zavas Cholavidvash, a land that flows milk and honey. So it's describing it as a land that flows milk and honey. And if Girgashi is not listed there, you can assume that it's maybe not such a land that flows milk and honey. It's part of the territory of Israel. Like Rashi says elsewhere that a certain land of Israel that was designated for cemeteries. It's not the best land. Okay. Let me read you the Nachmanides. Here. Sorry. Chapter 8. Sorry, chapter 3, verse number 8. He mentions six and drops the seventh. Ulai, perhaps, perhaps their land was not such flow, was not such a land that flows milk and honey. So that will explain the beginning of Exodus. But when it comes to Parshas Ki Sisa, our Torah portion, in our Torah portion, we're not talking about the land. In our Torah portion, we're talking about the conquest. God is talking about you're going to be going into the land, you're going to be facing the inhabitants of the land, who are mighty, they're strong, they're powerful, they're formidable. We saw how terrified the spies were when they went and they saw these giants, and these were extremely, extremely and very, very, very people trained at combat and at war. These were formidable armies. And God is saying that I'm going to send an angel with me, and the angel is going to do battle before you. So, over here, it doesn't make a difference. The land or no land, doesn't make a difference what kind of condition of the land. You still have to get rid of the inhabitants in order for the Jewish people to be able to settle there. You have to clear out the place. So Rashi is bothered. You're promising me you're getting rid of this, this, and this, and this might be scary. The Jews might say, hey, what's with the Girgashites? How about them? Why are they not mentioned? So that's why Rashi has to comment, Girgashi is not a problem. God didn't mention them because Girgashi, God knew they would leave on their own. And as a result of that, no need for the angel to kick them out. They will vacate. That's the reason why Rashi only makes the comment in this week's, and that's why, take a look. Vegerashti esaknani, it's Rashi quotes, I will drive out the Knani. Rashi says six nations are mentioned here, and the Girgashi left on their own. So now, once we have this basic foundation, now let's understand why it had to be quoted, why Rashi had to say it twice in this week's Torah portion. But before we go there, let's do a comparative analysis between these two Rashis. And as I mentioned earlier, it looks like Rashi is quoting the same thing verbatim. But if you take a very, very, very careful examination, you see that there are slight nuances, and that's what we're going to pay attention to right now. We're going to analyze the nuances that are different between these two Rashis. I find the genius of the Rebbe always is that he's at the same time able to see the entire picture, see the entire forest, and at the very same time, he's able to notice the tiniest, slightest differences in the smallest leaves on the trees, between this tree and that tree. And work with both. Work with the big subject and work with the tiniest. So here he notices the small differences between the two Rashis. He takes a microscopic look and a macro examination. So if you take a look at these two Rashis under the microscope, you'll notice as follows. Let's begin with the heading. In verse number 2, in the first Rashi that you have the comment, whenever Rashi makes a comment, he makes his comment on certain words of the verse. he clips one or two words, sometimes three words. He clips those words and then makes his comment on it. He cuts the words out. He makes copy-paste, takes one or two words from the words that he's going to use for his comment. So in the first one, Rashi makes his comment on the word vegerashti es haKnani. I will drive out the Knani, vegoimer, he adds vegoimer, which means all the rest of the nations. I am driving out them. Okay? But in the second comment, the one in 34:11, over there it also says, Hinini goyresh mipanecha, I am driving out from before you. But Rashi does not quote those words, Hinini goresh mipanecha. He just makes his comment on the word es ha'amori. He selects the first name that is mentioned, v'goymer, and all the other names. V'goymer means and the rest of the verse, which is the rest of the names. And he makes the comment just on the names of the nation, not including the words that I will drive out. And that is intentional. So again, by us, he quotes the words I will drive out, and his comment is meant to explain also I will drive out. But in the second comment, he omits the words I will drive out. Hinini goyresh. Okay? The other thing is, in the first comment in chapter 33, verse 2, Rashi says about the six nations, he says, Shisha umais hen. There are six nations listed. These words, Shisha umais hen. Six nations are. That's all he says. Six nations are. In the second Rashi, Rashi says, Shisha umois yesh kan. Six nations are here. So Rashi adds the word here. And he says, yesh kan, are here. Instead of saying, Shisha umois hein, six nations there are. Here he says, they are here. Following? Anybody who would think, eh, come on, you're being too nitty gritty. This is a divine commentary. We know that when Rashi wrote his commentary, he had divine assistance. So every little nuance is perfect. That's difference number two we just explained. Now difference number three. In the first Rashi, he says, V'hagir garshi, and the gergoshites. He says, six nations there are, and the gergoshi. Uses the word and. And here Rashi says, in the second Rashi, Rashi says, Ki hagir garshi, because the gergoshi. He doesn't say, and the Gergoshite. He says, because the Gergoshi. As if he's giving a reason. Here it's as if he's saying, hey, so what happened with the Gergoshi? So he says, and the Gergoshi. But here, he's like explaining, ki ha Gergoshi, because the Gergoshi. That's a little different in style. Why? And finally, in the first Rashi, it says, what happened to the Gergoshites? Omad upana mipneim, they stood up and they left from before them, from before the Jewish people. And he adds a word, may elav, on their own accord. They didn't need a fight. They left on their own. So Rashi emphasizes they left on their own. In the second Rashi, it says, ki har gergashi omad upana, the gergashi stood up and cleared out mipneim from before them. He doesn't say they left on their own. So what do we have over here? Four nuanced, small, these are tiny Rashis. Everybody learns them very quickly. The Rebbe stops and says, hey, take a look at all these cute little differences. Pay attention. Here, first in the heading, even though he seems to be saying the same thing, he quotes from the verse. He cuts and pastes different words from the verse. Second, That's difference number one. Secondly, in the first one, he says, Shisha Umais Hem, there are six nations. Here he says, Shisha Umais Yesh Khan, there are six nations present over here. In the first one, he says, Vehagar Gashi, and the other one, he says, Kihagar Gashi. Here he says, and the Gergashite. Here he says, because the Gergashite. And finally, the fourth difference is, in the first one, he says, they left on their own accord, and in the second one, he just emphasizes that they left, and he doesn't say they left on their own. But what a world of a difference when we understand the context. So, back to what we were saying before. Both these Torah verses that we're encountering over here in our Torah portion, Parshas Kisisa, is not talking about the land. It's talking about the conquest of the land. And that, they're the same. That's why Rashi is bothered in both cases. Where is the, what's with the Gergashi? But as we said before, the second comment is superfluous. He explained it already, what happened with the Gergashi. The Rebbe says, no, no, no. In the second comment, there is a reason to mention the Gergashi even though they vacated. There would be a reason. Why? Because let's take a look at the second verse. In the first verse, God is just giving Moshe information about how the conquest is going to happen. I'm sending an angel, and the angel will kick him out. Great. The angel will go, and he'll drive the nations out. The second verse, this whole verse, if you look at the contextual of the context, what you're seeing over there is, God is saying it as an introduction to warn the Jewish people of how they are to deal with the nations that are in the land. That they shouldn't make any covenants with them. They shouldn't make any deals with them. In other words, we're not over there coming to discuss how something about the conquest. It does mention the conquest, but it's only introductory words. I am coming, I will drive out the nations. Now be careful. Like some of the commentaries say, why is God saying, I'm kicking them out, and you're going to go and make covenants with them? It's like the Rebbe was screaming like crazy. The Rebbe was literally cried his heart out after the Six-Day War. He said, God performed for Israel the greatest miracles. I think seven armies of seven nations were decimated. I don't think something like that says six or seven. I'm not exactly how many armies there were decimated in 6 days. Israel didn't have anywhere close to the ammunition, to the abilities to do so. It was a clearly divine miracle. It was the hand of God, similar to almost to the biggest miracles of biblical proportion that happened during the Six-Day War. And immediately afterwards, Israel in its enormous stupidity and self-doubt and fear from the nations in the world. Discomfort, as a Jew, I can say it. Non-Jew shouldn't say it, but a Jew can say it. It's a Jewish weakness, it's a sickness. Because we've been in exile for 2,000 years close to it. We've become so abused that we have victim syndrome. Abuse syndrome. We don't have any self-respect. You won this battle miraculously with an incredible... So first of all, just because which nation wins territory in a defensive war and then goes the next day and gives it back and gives these lands back? It doesn't make any sense. For empty promises. They gave tremendous amount of land to Egypt, and Egypt attacked them. An empty promise. A few years later, they were back at war with Egypt in the Yom Kippur War. Insanity. But there the Rebbe emphasized exactly this point. God goes and gives you a gift, and you go and you're throwing it back in God's face? For 2,000 years, God is silent. He's not messing. He's not showing himself in this world. He finally shows himself and gives you a kiss. And you turn around and you take the land and give it back? Are you insane? The Rebbe says that all this intifada and all this that we're suffering today is because we've done that stupidity. And we keep on doing it again and again and again. It's like, what's insanity when you do the same thing and you expect different results?
We do the same thing again and again and again because there's another ridiculous world leader, I don't care who it is, who thinks he's brilliant and he's going to solve the Middle East conflict, not realizing, but they want to fight God. That's what it is. In utter stupidity, knowing that this is a conflict that is not going to be resolved because it's much deeper than just superficial politics. This goes to the very core of God's relationship with the world. It goes to the very core of Judaism and Islam. These are very, very deep, essential belief systems. The conflict is much deeper than the externality. We're going to make superficial, skin-deep pacts. It's never going to work. It's ridiculous. Even from a psychological place, it's insane. And all it does, it keeps on creating spirals of bloodshed. Spirals of bloodshed. Again and again. The Rebbe said, on both sides. Unnecessary deaths on the Palestinian side as well. No one wants bloodshed. But you can't make fake, phony resolutions. It doesn't work. In any case, so the second verses where it's mentioned the second time, over there, when God is telling you them, I'm giving you the land, do not make covenants with the people in the land. So over there, the main message over there of mentioning that God is driving is not the idea that he's driving them out, but it's an introduction to teach you the laws that with the seven, and that's a law. It's a Torah law. We're not allowed to make a covenant with the seven nations. Jews are allowed to make peace treaties with other nations. You're allowed to make treaties, but with the seven nations, you're not allowed to make a treaty. Now, is that with six nations or with seven nations? The idea that you're now going to make a treaty. So then that becomes the question. What's with the Girgashites? So even if we know earlier that the Girgashites left on their own, and you don't have to tell me now that the angel is not going to have to kick them out, that's not why Rashi makes that comment. We know that from before the Girgashites is going to leave before. But are you still allowed to make a covenant with the Girgashites if they come back? If there are some, not necessarily they left, did everybody leave? If there are some Girgashite people that are still, as a people, they left. So it would seem that what? That the next time it's mentioning, since it's not a story about the conquest, or a telling you about, if it's telling you how the conquest is going to happen, so then you had a question, what's with the Girgashite? And you say, Girgashite left, there's no need for the angel to kick them out. Fine. But now that we're talking about a setting of the rules, how you will engage with the nations, because even though they fought them and the Torah tells them to fight them, you see that many the nations stayed there for a long time. The Jews never finished the job. They always had. God was actually upset about them. He was upset at King David for not cleaning out Israel at that time. But yet, so the rule remained. You're not allowed to make treaties with them. So in that context, the question is, what's with the Girgashites? So for here, Rashi has to explain that what? The reason why the Torah does not tell you about, does not mention the Girgashi, is because there's no worry to make a treaty with them. Why is there no worry to make a treaty with them? Because by the time you're coming into the land of Israel, they weren't there anymore. They were gone already. So take a look at the Rashi. The second Rashi. Esa Moiri, Rashi says, now she emphasized, look at the words. Shisha umois yesh kan. There are six nations over here. That means when you're going to be entering the land, there are six nations over here. So with them, I have to warn you not to do business. With them, with the nations that are here, I need to warn you. Why? So Rashi says, Kia Girgashi, because they're Girgashi. Amadu panem ipnem. Girgashi had left before that already. Before the Jewish people even came into the land, the Girgashi wasn't there anymore. You see, if the Girgashi was lingering around and then they left on their own without a war, there would still be a need to make a covenant with them, because you're going to be walking on the streets and you might meet a Girgashite and you might want to make a deal with them. So Rashi over here has to mention they left already. And interesting over here, therefore on the second Rashi, Rashi doesn't say that they left on their own. It doesn't make a difference how they left. The main point is that they're not there anymore. By the time the Jewish people came into the land, the Girgashites were nowhere to be seen. So the Torah doesn't have to warn us not to make a peace treaty with the Girgashites, because they were nowhere to be seen. They weren't there anymore. And that's why Rashi says the word Kia Girgashi, caused the Girgashi. And that's why Rashi doesn't mention over there Hinini Goyresh. When Rashi makes the setting of the word, when Rashi clips the word, because Rashi is not concerned about the actual how the conquest will happen. By us, it's important to say how the conquest will happen in the first verse, because it's actually talking about the conquest. The second verse is not talking about the conquest. It's talking about the presence of the nations in the land of Israel. When you come in, it will take a while till everybody will be out. During that time, it's telling you how to deal with them. So the whole Hinini Goyresh is not important over here. Rashi says, how many nations are listed here? Well, we're not allowed, why aren't we supposed to make deals with seven nations? No, Rashi says only six they were warned upon. You know why? Because the seventh didn't have to be warned upon because they weren't there. But now let's go back to the first Rashi and see how perfect the first Rashi is. In the first Rashi where it says, where he's actually talking about the conquest, over there Rashi quotes the words, V'geirashti esaknani. Rashi, because here the question is on the conquest itself. God says, I will drive out. That's how they're going to be. Don't think you're going to have to battle them. The angel will battle them on God's behalf. The Geirashti. So hold it. What's with the Girgashi? So Rashi says, Shisha Umay said, only six nations are mentioned. It doesn't say Yesh Khan. It's not an issue of whether they're here or not. There are six nations listed here. There are six nations here. What's with the seventh? That's why Rashi doesn't say kihag, because, not because, the Hagirgashi, you're wondering what happened with the second, with the seventh one. So Rashi says, amad upana mipnehem, they stood up and they left from before them, may elav, on their own. Because that's the main point in this Rashi. That they left on their own, we didn't need the angel to fight them. Not only didn't we have to fight them, we didn't even need the angel to fight them. Because they left on their own. So these two Rashis are so beautiful. They're so perfect. Every word is so perfect, explaining two different things. The Rebbe only says, halachically, one can question. This is commentary. But then in halachically, hypothetically, one can question. According to halacha, according to Rashi, from Rashi's perspective in halacha, is the prohibition against making a covenant with six nations, or is the prohibition against making a covenant with seven nations? Why would there be a possibility that the prohibition is with seven nations if they weren't even there when they came into the land? Because they were still living in the land while God made this prohibition. When God made the prohibition, it was in the beginning of the 40 years, He still had 40 years in the desert. For the next 40 years, the Girgashites were still living nice and soundly in their homes. So maybe since when the covenant was made against making truces with the inhabitants of the land, it included the Girgashites as well. Or maybe not. Since God knew that they would leave, they were from the very beginning never included in the prohibition. So if you look at Maimonides says it's a prohibition against all seven nations. But maybe according to Rashi, since the Girgashites are not mentioned, maybe there's no prohibition against them. Or maybe they are, because they were there at that time. And hypothetically, first of all, what happens if a few remained? When you say they left, doesn't mean everybody left. It could be a few remain. And thirdly, what happens if one day they come back? You know it's the same. They have the DNA. These are the Girgashites who moved to Africa. And they actually come back. Are you allowed to make a truce? By the way, the Talmud relates that there were once people in Africa who came to take the Jewish people to The Hague, to the court. You think it's the first time Israel was taken to court? Back in the days of Alexander the Great, the Talmud says that there were people from Africa. So commentators say the people of Africa were the Girgashites. Because they had moved to Africa, they were coming with the complaint. And according to one of the commentaries, a very beautiful explanation, I think the Chidah, he says that, because really the question is, you're coming in front of Alexander. Alexander is a conqueror, isn't he? Is he not? What do you think he was doing? He was busy conquering lands everywhere. So what does he mean you come to him and you complain that a different nation stole your land? Duh, what is Alexander doing? And in general, that's the way nations worked. Throughout all of history, there was a conquest of nations. And it was considered legal, meaning once a nation conquered another nation by war, then that land belonged to them. So Israel had full right over the land. It seemed like they had some kind of a complaint that the Africans who came, now it's also South Africa that decided to do it. Maybe they're the maybe they still have a grudge still from the Girgashites. I'm not exactly sure. It's interesting. I never thought of that. There it says the Africans came and South Africa decided to be the speakers for Hamas, to take Hamas's and they come with take Israel to court. But the explanation that he gives is that since Girgashi was never, there was no war. Since it was no war, there was never a conquest. So that's why they felt they had a legal claim. We just left, and now we want our land back. No, it's conquest. It's conquest, but they never conquered it. That's the thought. But in any case, halachically, so the Rebbe actually wants to say that from Rashi's words, it seems to imply, since Rashi says ki hagirgashi amad upana mipneim, implies that it's not a, that really essentially the prohibition is against all seven. The reason the Torah doesn't mention all seven is because technically Girgashi wasn't there. But hypothetically, if Girgashi will come back, the same thing would apply. That's what he wants to derive from the words of Rashi, halachically. That Rashi would agree with Maimonides and with the Chinuch and with some other great halachic codifiers that this is one of the 613 commandments, that we're not allowed to make a peace treaty with the dwellers of the land of the seven nations. So that it actually applies to all seven. Okay, this is all the extroteric discussion. And now we're going to open this up to the esoteric discussion. Because everything in the physical world has its replica, and not just its replica, has its source in the spiritual, psychological, inner world. The seven nations who lived in the land of Canaan were seven powers of impurity, plugged into the seven powers, the seven unholy emotions. We know that the entire world is built on seven energies, seven powers, stemming from God's seven powers. Shiva Midos, the seven Midos. Kindness, severity, beauty, which is compassion, victory, which is Netzach, perseverance, Hod, glory, submission, Yesod, foundation, which means connection. And finally, Malchus, royalty. Being that God created the holy and the unholy, and the unholy mirrors and reflects the holy. As the verse says, Zeh l'uma zeh asa Elokim, God created one versus the other. Holiness should be countered by a counter force that is in the same, that has the same powers as holiness. So there's a holy structure and an unholy structure. So the forces, the satanic forces, the forces of darkness, the forces that oppose God are also built with these seven emotions. And in simple words, every human being has the potential to live these seven emotions. As a whole. These seven emotions make up the inner emotional structure of every human being. And every human being can live these emotions in a holy way, in a godly way. And you can live these emotions in a corrupted, evil way. So for instance, love is the first emotion. Is love good or bad? Depends who you love, what you love. If you put your love in its right place, if you love your children appropriately, if you love your parents, if you love a fellow human being in a healthy, godly manner, if you fall in love with a person of the opposite gender that you're supposed to, that you could get married, and you get married according to law, whether Jewish law or according to the Torah law that the Torah sets for non-Jews as well, and you respect each other and live in that context, then the love is a holy love. It's a reflection of God's love. But if the love turns into lust and it becomes an improper love, love in an impure way, it turns into sinful love, then that's the corrupted emotion of love. And the same is in the power of gevurah, discipline, judgment and discipline, the power of restraint. If it's used in a proper way to discipline ourselves or to discipline others in a gentle and a way that is necessary, we're responsible to discipline, to have certain... it's our responsibility when we see things that are wrong to do our part to set them right, which sometimes involves severity and strictness on the people that we have influence on, then that's a healthy, godly thing. If we use our severity and our judgment and our whatever in a corrupted manner to subjugate, to dominate, to... for our own selfish purposes, that's a corruption of our gevurah. We cast fear on others in an unhealthy way. That's a corruption of the emotion of fear and emotion of severity. And so compassion, it can be holy compassion, it can be unholy compassion. Compassion on criminals is an unholy compassion. Even on criminals, it's not an unholy compassion. If you have compassion on criminal in a way where you give them a sentence but you try to lighten it within a certain context, that's okay. But if you're setting them free, or if you're allowing them to perpetrate their crime again, then that is unholy compassion. It's misplaced compassion. And so on and so forth. Victory and submission. Every emotion has its holy expression and its unholy expression. On a deeper level, we know that we are made up of two souls. Not just that we can direct our emotions in two different, in towards holiness and towards unholiness. We are two beings. We have a godly soul. It's a piece of God from above that is comprised from these seven holy emotions. And we have an animal soul. That's our shell. Our more superficial reality that's unholy. So if we live life deeply, and we live on a deeper level, and we connect to our inner purpose, to our inner soul, our godly soul, and we live from that space, then our emotions are all holy emotions. But if we allow ourselves just to cruise through life on a superficial, external level, and our energies are all just impulsive, what comes easily and naturally, these are going to be our selfish, animalistic emotions, which will be unholy and ungodly. When the Jewish people were challenged to go and conquer the land, it was an external exercise, but it reflected an internal conquest. That means every single person of the Jewish people needed to work very, very difficult, needed to do some deep soul work in their own psyche to chase out the impure emotions and to replace them with the holy, godly emotions. That's what it means to conquer the land of the seven nations. The seven nations, the seven tribes that were living there, they were physical embodiments of these very, very dark energies, and the impure emotions. The spirit, and only God can say that, because God knows the soul. He created the soul, so he knows the soul. Physically, the Jews would drive them out of the land, and the Jews living there who had this deeper capacity of their godly being. But it meant within each and every one of us also that we needed to conquer our own impure emotions, which are there naturally from birth. Because again, if a person doesn't work to deepen their consciousness, the natural development is of our selfish egos. And our emotions are all going to be corrupted emotions. Corrupted in the sense is that they serve ourselves. They don't serve a higher purpose. That's its corruption. It will be self-serving love. It will be self-serving discipline. It will be self-serving compassion, and so on and so forth. So the war of conquering the land implies the conquering of all of our seven various different drives that drive all of human behavior. So now the question is, and therefore it's explained, that the Amorites, the Hittites, each one, and it's hinted to in their names, which one of the seven emotions they personify. So what is the Girgashi that we're talking about? The Girgashites, who left on their own. So being that they are the seventh nation, it is explained in the book Kehilas Yaakov. It's a book on Kabbalah from a student. I didn't realize that he was such a late Kabbalist. He was a student from the Chose from Lublin. So we're talking about someone who lived about 250 years ago. He was a student of the great seer of Lublin. I think his last name was Kalish. And he wrote the Sefer Kehilas Yaakov. It's basically an index on Kabbalah. It's called, many people wrote such books where they take certain themes and they explain the Kabbalistic concepts behind these ideas or themes. So this Sefer Kehilas Yaakov, I'm going to know more about it, Be'ezus Hashem, in 2-3 weeks, because I was busy with it today, I ordered it. So I'm going to have it, 3 volumes, Be'ezrat Hashem. I'm going to add it to our Mayan library. But in any case, I did manage to find it on HebrewBooks.com and look up the actual index. So he has an insert on the word Girgashi. He explains the seven nations. He explains Girgashi. And he says Girgashi is the malchut of the klipa. It's the power of kingship. It's the last of the seven emotions. It's the feminine emotion. The 6 emotions are masculine emotions, and the 7th emotion is the feminine emotion. What is that? What does it mean? The 7th emotion. The 7th emotion is not so much of an emotion. It's bringing all the emotions into expression. What is Malchus? We learned this many times. Malchus is speech. Speech is expression. Expressing something to the outside, that is Malchus. The emotions themselves are feelings inside the person. The malchut is really hooks on to every emotion, takes whichever emotion is and expresses it to the outside. In other words, malchut brings the emotion into behavior. So what really is malchus? Malchus is thought, speech, and action. Because when you have an emotion, the emotion could be dormant. When you allow that emotion to come into your thought, for instance, there are probably some people that we're angry at because they hurt us and insulted us or offended us or whatever. But right at this moment, you're not feeling any anger because you're not thinking about it. But if someone would bring up, you know, that person start talking to you suddenly, you know, half an hour later, you find yourself, you know, you got a little high blood pressure. Why? Because you allow that emotion to enter your consciousness through your thought. Thought is revealing it to yourself. And then when you're so upset that you pick up the phone and you speak to your whatever and you get and you let it out in words as well, that's expressing it in words. And then if you're writing it or typing an email because you're so angry or something like that, you're allowing the emotion into action. So all three stages, thought, speech, and action, they're all part of the malchus. Malchus is behavior. It's an emotion, but it's the emotion that's like, it's translating all the emotions into the behavior. And that's why the Kehilas Yaakov, and that's interesting, Kehilas Yaakov just, in his book, he doesn't speak about it being thought, speech, and action. That's already the Rebbe's interpretation. But based on Chabad Chassidus. But what it does say in the book, Kehilas Yaakov, again, what he does say over there is that Malchus is the feminine emotion, and the female is a recipient. She doesn't have anything of her own. Malchus is just a reflector of all the emotions. It basically, this idea, it takes the emotions and it reflects it to the outside. So based on this idea, the Kehilas Yaakov says, this great ancient, this not, again, not so ancient, as I mentioned earlier, but this book of Kabbalah says, great idea. He explains that's why the Gergashi left on their own. He says, because once you defuse the emotions, there's nothing to express. Once you transfer all your unholy love, then you're not going to be acting on an unholy love. You don't love anything that's not holy. Once you've gotten rid of all negative anger, so you're never going to speak angry words. The angry words are coming because there's anger in your emotion. But if you diffuse the emotion, or you redirected the emotion, or you transformed your emotions and that redirected it into its appropriate place, so the unholy expression of emotion won't happen. What's Gergashi? Gergashi is the acting out of all the emotions. But once the emotions have already been cleaned and clarified and elevated and purified and transformed, there's no need for fight the Gergashi. Are you going to go fight the unholy behavior? Why would anybody misbehave if there's no evil inclination, no one is misbehaving anymore? It's the energy first. So that's the whole idea. The six nations were fought. The seventh one is gone. If the first six are eliminated, then like the moon receives her light from the sun. That's the female idea. It receives her light from the sun. But if the sun is extinguished, there's no moon anymore. So there's no more unholy moon automatically when there's no more unholy sun. The six emotions are the six nations were the unholy sun, and the Gergashite was the unholy moon. So she can only reflect the light if there is what to reflect. That's the premise. That it says in Kehilas Yaakov regarding this concept of why Gergashi was out the door. Based on this, the Rebbe says, so now we'll understand the difference between the two Rashis. It's really cool. We'll understand the difference between the two Rashis, and that's as follows. The first Rashi, and again, we'll see how it follows the same theme like he's taking. The first Rashi, the first verse, again, in this Torah portion in Kisisa, is talking about the order of the conquest. I'm sending my angel will take you into the land, you're conquering the land. If you want to know the order of your conquest, of how you conquer yourself to become a holy being, a godly being, your own land, your own body, you want to make sure that your territory, your physical life is going to become a holy life. When you're born with an animalistic soul that is prone to all kinds of impure and negative behaviors because you have a whole slew of negative emotions, which we develop as a child automatically because we're more animalistic when we're children. We don't have the higher consciousness, the higher mind yet. So just growing up in a physical world, we pamper our ego, and by the time we become a teenager, it's pretty, pretty robust. And then when you're 20 and so on, you really got yourself a serious, unholy animal self. And now we got to deal with that. So the real conquest, if you really want to transform yourself completely on a deep level, you start by studying a lot, getting to know the world of the holy, meditating on it, getting closer to it. And as a result of that, you start changing your emotions. Because we learned this many times, our emotions follow our intelligence. So the more we grow in our knowledge, what is worthy of love, what is worthy of fear, what is worthy of compassion, and so on and so forth. So by rewiring our minds, we rewire our heart. And then automatically, when you rewire your heart, eventually you'll come to a point that you'll never have to struggle with any negative behavior. Because there's no struggle anymore, because there's no negative emotion. So the order of the way it works in terms of full conquest of the land is the first Rashi, is the first verse. Where there it says that what? You conquer the six nations. You conquer the six nations. And then you're going to wonder, Gergashi, what's with the Gergashi? Rashi tells you, the Gergashi, they vacated on their own. No reason for any fight anymore. You're never going to have to fight your negative behavior because you've already did inside cleaning. You removed the energies that would motivate that behavior. You don't have that desire anymore to have that behavior. You've done some deep therapy to change, to transform, so the behavior will automatically disappear. However, this is a lifetime of work, and not everybody achieves a complete transformation of their inner human being. So we learn in Tanya that most people might never achieve this. So if I have not yet conquered my inner demons, if I haven't yet transformed my negative emotions, so I might argue and say, if I have these emotions, I have to let them out. If I have these emotions, after all, I have this love. Like today, that's today's world. Just because I have a feeling towards something, it must be it's kosher and it's correct. The concept of having to work to redirect a love is so foreign in today's world. Because people have a natural tendency. This is where my heart is pulling me. And therefore what? It's holy, it's godly. If God says not correct way to live, then you got to do the work to change it. I can't. We all have a lot of emotions that we have to change. It's work. But here's the thing. If a person has a very aggressive nature and they love dominating and they love bullying and that aggressive nature, let's say they have it because their parents were aggressive and their great-grandparents, they just have it in their DNA. So until they're going to change it, therefore they're allowed to bully everybody. God forbid. So in Tanya, we speak about the concept of a Beinoni. A Beinoni means the intermediate, not the tzaddik. Or someone who's less than the Beinoni, the struggling human being, who still has negative emotions, and yet he is told that he may not act it out, that we have to control our behavior, that our behavior has to be consistent with God's will, whether internally we are consistent with God or we're not consistent with God's will, if we are internally moral or if we are internally corrupt or have a corrupted side internally, we still have to control our behavior. And God created a human being with the mechanics that we can behave contrary to our emotions of our heart. And do the godly thing even though we don't feel the godly thing. Thought, speech, and action has to be according to God's will. whether the six nations have already been driven out of your heart, whether the six corrupt nations have not been driven out of their heart, you still got to get rid of the Girgashi. So it would be beautiful like it is in the first Rashi, where in the first Rashi we're talking about that you have your angel, your spiritual angel, you fight the six negative emotions, you get rid of them, and then automatically your behavior is already scot-free. No reason to guard, no reason to be. You're a tzaddik. That's a tzaddik. That's a righteous. That's a saintly in the person. That's a saintly individual. The external is a result of the internal. But in the later verses, where God is instructing the Jewish people on their behavior in the land, not the order of the conquest, but on their behavior, practical, God is saying, we can't wait till you'll become a tzaddik before you start behaving like a tzaddik. You can't wait till you'll become a saint until you start behaving like. There are the do's and there are the don'ts. So that's why Rashi says. So again, that's what we're explaining. That's why we should have mentioned Girgashi over here. Because over here, you got to deal with Girgashi. Remember, we're explaining why Rashi still has to make the comment the second time. That means that Girgashi should be mentioned. Because Girgashi is not someone you can just write off. And that's why Rashi emphasizes, Shishan umos yesh kan. You have six negative emotions still in your heart. Gewalt! Your heart is still filled with these dark, dark energies. If so, you still have to deal with Girgashi. So what's with Girgashi? So Rashi says, oh, yeah, Girgashi should be mentioned. But Girgashi is still not mentioned. Why? Ki ha Girgashi amad and what's the words of Rashi? Because the heart, now let me get it over here. Lamed, because the Girgashi left on his own. So what does that mean? No, Rashi doesn't say on his own. He just left. What does that mean? That simply would mean you're still not allowed to give expression to those negative behaviors. But in Rashi, it seems to imply it happened on its own. Not that you were controlling it. It happened on its own. So he adds, very, very, very special. In Tanya, it says that even when our animal soul is not yet rectified, and we have two powerful combating souls, the godly and the unholy, there is a certain natural programming that God programmed that when a person activates their godly soul, even though, for example, when in the mind there is a conviction of how am I supposed to live? And the heart, however, doesn't feel that way. The heart is burning with temptation. The heart is burning with desire. But the person is thinking and activates their higher consciousness. And there is a clash, and you feel the clash. There is a natural superiority to the godly soul over the animal soul. Why? Because the godly soul is light and the animal soul is darkness. And the way it works with light and darkness is when you turn on the light, the darkness dissipates on its own. What does that mean? If it's a dark room and you turn on a light, so you have a conflict over here between the light and the darkness. Do you ever see a literal war going on between the light and the darkness? And it should take a few minutes. It should flash. It should get dark, light. Light, this powerful war going on. And then finally the darkness, the light prevails over the darkness, and the darkness is out. Doesn't work that way. The moment you introduce the light, the darkness is not here anymore. And that's because God has to step in. Or else we would lose every battle. So God weighs in. And he adds extra assistance to the godly soul. He gave it the quality that of light over darkness. And that's the reason is, if I'm feeling a tug of war taking place in my soul, it's pulling me in two directions. On the one hand, I want to do what's right. On the other hand, there is the earthiness in me that wants to sin or do something that's utterly selfish and not according to God's, to what I know, what my better self knows. So if I decide that I want to listen to my soul and I want to do the right thing, with divine assistance, the negative steps aside and the godly prevails. And that's the reason that Rashi says over here, Shisha Umos Yeshkan, there are six nations over here. That means, and therefore the Gergashi should be, the seventh one should have been stuck following them, because the six emotions want to flow into behavior. They want to like just enter into the Gergashi zone of expression. Yet, Gergashi Amad Bifneyam, the Gergashi leaves on its own. Emphasizing on its own, because we have the divine assistance to help that happen on its own. So according to this, There are two paths, if you might say, of dealing with Gergashi. One path of dealing with Gergashi is that Gergashi becomes irrelevant because the heart is cleansed, like it's going to be in the days of Mashiach, when the heart is cleansed. There will never be sin. Why won't there be sin? Because there will be only bright hearts. All of our emotions will be pure and holy and godly. So there will be never a temptation. Like God says, you know, the evil inclination will be killed. And God says, I will take away your stone of heart and I will give you a stone of flesh. We will really be sensitive to godliness and to holiness. And our hearts will be ablaze with love for God and awe of God. So that's one way. So even today, it's possible to get to that stage. Obviously everybody in accordance to their level. But then there is another element of Gergashi, where one has got to deal with Gergashi even before we take care of the six other emotions. But even then, you got the assistance of Hashem that you just have to want to. And their Gergashi, the negative behavior will step out, will step aside. Now, what's really, really exciting over here, which I really think is interesting, is that there were a few videos that were going around recently on YouTube, and I got it, a lot of people sent it to me, from a few rabbis who were quoting a teaching from the Rebbe's father, from the Lubavitch Rebbe's father, Kutei Levi Yitzchak, in which they were saying that Gaza is, that the Rebbe's father said that when Gaza will fall, the temple will be built. The Beis HaMikdash will be built. And since we are so close now, like to the fall of Gaza, Israel has already cleaned up most of the space. Place. There's just the Rafah place, but most of Gaza has been already. So right, the temple is going to be built and it's a sign of Mashiach. And there was a lot of talk about it. I obviously got excited about that and I went and I checked it up. And I think whoever is spreading this is completely over-talking. Meaning, yes, I believe we're at the threshold of Mashiach, but it's one thing. You have to still be careful what you're saying. If you're saying something in the name of the Rebbe's father, it has to be that he really says it, not that you're saying it and that he and you're pinning it on him. So I looked in the source and I learned it twice. Once a few weeks ago when this thing, 2 weeks ago when it was coming out, and then today again. The Rebbe's father does not say that. It doesn't say that at all. However, I understand where it's coming. The Rebbe's father in his book, Likutei Levi Yitzchak, mentions that Shimshon, Samsonite, says, went down to Gaza, and over there, the Palestinians wanted to attack him, and they thought they had him locked in. In the middle of the night, he stood up in the middle of the night, and he uprooted the entire gate to the city with its two side walls. He uprooted, picked it up onto its shoulder, and he went on top of Hebron to the top of the mountain, and he dropped it over there. In other words, they thought they have him locked into the city and they'll be able to attack him. Meanwhile, he went and he picked up the whole gate, the whole fence, which is massive stones, and the two side pillars, the whole thing, and he took it. So the Rebbe's father goes on to explain that Gaza is the malchut of Klipa. It's the malchut element of the unholy. And he proves it. I'm gonna go into it a little bit in a few moments. And it is the antithesis to the temple, to the Beis HaMikdash. Because the Beis HaMikdash, the temple, is the malchut of Kedusha. So somebody decided that because he calls this malchut and this malchut, so the guy made 1 + 1 = 2, and the maiden decided to take it to the next stage and say, so therefore, when this malchut falls, this malchus will rise. And as a result of that, the Beis HaMikdash will be built. So the person, and on so many videos, I received it from so many people. The Rebbe's father says that when Gaza will fall, the Beis HaMikdash will be built. Be careful. He doesn't say that. Now, if you know the Rebbe's father's style, everything to him is always Kabbalah. And he has thousands of things where he explains, this is the Malchut, and this is the Yesod, and this is the... So to make such blanket statements. Now, it's perfectly fine to say that since you saw in the Rebbe's father's writings that what? That Gaza is Malchus. And we know what the Talmud tells us that what? And he also says that the Beis HaMikdash is also Malchus. The temple is Malchus. And we know what it says, that when one kingdom falls, the other kingdom rises. So since now we're talking about the fall of, almost the fall of Gaza, let us hope that when the fall of Gaza will, then the Beis HaMikdash will. But that's perfectly fine to say, because then you're saying that it makes sense, this is your thought. And that's okay. But you can't say the Rebbe's father says that when that's going to happen, this is going to happen. It's wrong. You can't put words in someone's mouth that he didn't say. And you have to be careful when you do that. I just want to make sure that people know that. And I was actually going to make a little voice memo on that, because it bothers me, because you can't overstate things. I'm usually the one who brings all the hype, but still, I'm careful. If I'm saying something, I think, this is what it says here, based on that, it comes out that this so-and-so-and-so. But that's my thought. That's not what he says. And even, okay? Now, based on all of, however, I want to connect this idea with what we're learning right now. The Rebbe's father over there says, the verse says that Samson, Shimshon, the Gibar, the mighty one, went in the middle of the night in Gaza. So first he said he met a prostitute there, and he cohabited with her. It's hard to understand. The Shimshon is supposed to be a big tzaddik, and we're finding him with prostitutes. The whole thing is a story that is just beyond our comprehension. And when you read the Kabbalistic interpretation, then things make sense. But when you start to read the story just on the level of that, it's very hard to understand. And then he goes and he meets another girl, which he falls in love with her, and she's the one who extracts the secret from him that all his power is in his hair. She got paid off by the Philistinian heads, the chiefs. And they promised her a lot of silver if she will get the secret of what his strength is. And then in the end, he tried to give her the run of the mill, gave her three, which all were not. And then finally she got it out of him. And then in the end, they cut his hair. She cut his hair. I'm not exactly the full story, I don't remember. And he lost his might, and then they were able to get him. But in this short little piece in Torah Levi Yitzchak, it's all the way in the end of the book, Torah Levi Yitzchak, Chidushim Ebiurim L'Shas Mishneh V'Gemara. It's the last page, literally. Or the second to the last page. On page, yeah, Tafnun Beis, Tafnun Gimel. Beautiful piece. Really beautiful. It's like, it's what's so beautiful is it explains what Aza is. What Gaza is. In the Torah, Gaza is called Aza. So he goes and explains like this, that Gaza is the Malchut, the female element of the Klipa, the Malchut of the Klipa, that's Gaza. I'm not going to go into all the mysticism, maybe we'll do it another time, how it's hinted to in the name, the Hebrew name Aza. Ayin, Zayin, Hey. He explains it magnificently, why it's the Malchut of the Klipa and where its power is from. It's from the world of Tohu, from the place of shattered vessels. It's very, very interesting explanation. He explains that's why the prostitute is there. Because the female of Klipa is the opposite of modesty. She's a prostitute. And that's why in Aza is where he meets the prostitute. Because he's dealing with the spiritual force, the feminine force of the Klipa. And he explains that when he uproots the door, it says the words over there are, he picked up the doors, shara ear of the entrance of the city, ubishteha mezuzais, and the two doorposts. Vayisaim, and he lifted them up im habriach, with the bar. They had a big, massive bar that would keep the doors locked. So he picked the whole, they thought to have him trapped. He came there and he lifted the entire doorway, the whole archway. We're soon going to see from the Talmud how massive this was. And he lifted the whole thing up on his shoulders and he took it to the mountain of Hebron, overseeing Hebron. Okay. So the Rebbe's father explains this all mystically, what this all means, why he's taking it to Hebron. But just in short, he says that the two doors and the mezuzos and all of that is the womb of the Malchut of the Klipa. And literally, when he grabbed it and he picked it up, means he uprooted the womb of the Malchut of the Klipa, which is where all the energy is of the Malchut of the Klipa, is in her womb. Now, he says that this whole Aza, two doors, the Talmud says that Shimshon was a very big person, very broad. His shoulders were 60 cubits. Why? Because he put the doors on his shoulder. And the Talmud says, Talmud and Tractate Sota, on page number 10, the Talmud says over there, Gemiri, we learned that the walls of Gaza were no less, the doorway of Gaza were no less, we have a tradition, the Talmud says, than 60 cubits. 60 cubits. If you're wondering how long that is and how big that is, it's hard to believe that the Talmud is actually saying Shimshon HaGibbo was such a wide person, because then he would be longer than a building. Because the first temple, its length, its size, it was 60 cubits. The entire temple. So, it's hard to believe that the Talmud means it literally. But based on what we're learning over here, it's spiritually. He explains how the Beit HaMikdash is also the Malchut element. And he brings from the Zohar that the Beit HaMikdash, the house, the Talmud says that a house, also, a woman is also called a house. The Mishnah says the woman is a house. She's the primary being of a home. She is the home. So the home of God is the Shekhinah, is the woman of God. That's the Malchut. So the Beis HaMikdash is the holy woman. And its length was 60 cubits. So the doors of Gaza, which were also, is the antithesis to the Beis HaMikdash, to the Holy Temple. He also explains that it says Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon, had 60 mighty men surrounding his bed. All the kings were always paranoid, right? So you always were afraid for assassinations. So King Solomon had 60 mighty men with drawn swords around his bed. Shlomo HaMelech had no reason to be paranoid. He had no threats to his life. He lived in a time of peace. Achashverosh did have a reason to be paranoid, but not King Solomon. So the 60 mighty men that were around his bed was to fight off the impure klipa that's there. But he says, since Shlomo is Malchus, and his bed particularly is the womb of Malchus, and the 60 mighty men, because that's the 60, he connects the idea of 60 to this, just like the Beis HaMikdash is 60, and the doors of Gaza 60. So this is a fascinating explanation. But why is this interesting? Because if this is the case, based on what we're saying, it fits very well with what we're learning now. If Gaza is the Malchut of the Klippa, then we can then now connect Gaza to the Girgashi as well. Just like when we enter the land of Israel, we're just reading that the Malchut can either be the first ones to be eliminated, if we stop our negative behavior before we stop our negative emotions. Or the Malchut can be the last one that just dissipates on its own, because once the 7-6 negative emotions are cleansed, there's no room for any Malchut at all. Malchut is gone on its own. So based on this concept, we can draw that towards Gaza as well. And this is where I would like to say that since we are now after the battle, we've already purified all the 6 emotions. Because the Rebbe says the work is done already. Everything has been already transformed. So now there is no room for Malchut of Klippa at all. It needs to disappear on its own. In our lives, it means that we should be finding already within ourselves, we should already be heading into the headspace and into the heart space, that we don't have to struggle anymore with not sinning or not doing negative things, because we should already be entering into the days of Mashiach where we start feeling already a holy heart with a holy compassion, with a holy passion. It should start becoming natural to us to behave in a godly way, because there's no energy anywhere else other than it is. If we're not feeling that, we still have to combat. Of course, there's no excuse. And I do want to say, you find something interesting. What do you see regarding Gaza? You see that the Gazans at this point have nothing left besides social media. And their only power that they have today is just the Malchut, which is what? It's just propaganda. That's all that it is. All there is propaganda. There's nothing else to it but propaganda. And also, militarily, Israel is way stronger than them now, and always was. So in an internal level, it's over. The only thing that they're fighting with is they have world opinion. They have world opinion based on what? They have a very strong Malchut going. But there's no content there. It's just fabricated outright lies without any substance. So you have an empty, but there's nothing really there anymore. And therefore, it should disappear, poof. We should be able to look it in the eye and say, empty, it's nothing there. And here's, I believe, and within ourselves, it's the same thing. When we are being fed from our animal soul, or from within our experience, we're being fed like behaviors. We're being suggested to us behaviors that are not consistent with godliness. We should realize that they're really, really, really empty, and they're not going to bring us any satisfaction at all. Because we should realize that there's no real backing to it in our own psyche. We should realize that we don't even have an evil inclination for it. We should realize that the six nations have already been dead cosmically. So we should be able to tell ourselves, our own Yetzirah, stop selling merchandise that's outdated. You're coming over here to sell. If you guys are going to come sell us now, you know, the other day I needed, I'm looking for old classes of mine that I can't find online and we want to post them. So we found some old iPods. Not iPods. Yeah, iPods. Well, you had music on it. Today it's becoming already old. It's a few years ago. It's just a few. The technology is so quick that, you know, the ones that you were, it's like the, for a while they had these iPods. Before everybody had phones that were able to carry all your music, they had these little, so we found one and I had to order in order to charge it. I found it like in the, I had to order an old, I was able to find it still on Amazon to be able to charge it to see if I have old classes on it. And we actually did find them. We're going to upload them. But it's like old dated technology. Are you going to sell me? It's like no one is excited about it anymore. It's like the merchandise that is being peddled from our evil inclination is so outdated already. We're still buying into it because it's as if we still have a desire for them. It's as if it's gone. The only thing left in our hearts truly and deeply is our love for God. The world is holy already. We want something deep and real. The superficial stuff is empty. It's nothing. It's like the Gazans trying to sell Bubba Mises. Empty, hollow, anything. All there is a malchut. There's nothing inside it. There's no juice flowing in it. I'm not saying that it doesn't mean that at an individual level a person can't find that there's a little remnant. But if you, a little remnant of real Yetzirah. But if you tell yourself that this is so outdated, why do I have to be the last shlemazel to drop my Yetzirah? It's already gone. Its energy is already dissipating. It's being lost. There's no more fire in it. Because all fire is already transferred to holiness. So I have to be the last loser who's still facilitating in my heart some of this garbage, some of this toxic stuff. It's gone. In other words, tell yourself the six nations are gone already. So then Gergashi? Try it for 3 months and then come back to me and tell me if it didn't work. Tell yourself we're in the days of Mashiach. This is outdated stuff. I don't even believe you anymore, Yetzirah, when you tell me that I still want this. I don't want it. I'm not interested. I have no, it's not. A few years ago, yes, now no more. It doesn't speak to me anymore. So as we do this internally, this will manifest also on the world at large, that the fake external malchut of the klipa that's still operating in Gaza is going to be gone in a poof. Mashiach will be here. Our malchus the kedusha is going to be built. We'll be able to pour all of our holy desires and holy wants into our malchut, which is in our holy temple, and come to full expression, the full godliness of our soul, the full truths of who we really are. May we merit that all of this should happen today, now.